Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Big Bang and Creationism podcast. In the last week or two, I've been getting a lot of emails regarding time, what time is, and a little bit about time travel. So that's going to be the topic of this week's episode. But before I begin, I'd first like to do a creationist claim, because we haven't done one of those in a while. But even before that, I'd like to talk about a little mistake I made in the last episode. I'd like to thank Brett for making me aware of this mistake. He gave me an email in response to my discussion about the strong nuclear force. If you remember, I had stated that quarks cannot be separated from their original partners in the last episode. This isn't actually true. Quarks are never found alone in the universe. This is true. This phenomenon is called confinement. However, these quarks can be separated from their original partners. What happens is the energy that is put into the system to cause these quarks to separate, it spawns new quarks. It spawns new particles so that we never find these quarks alone. When we are able to separate them, the very act of separation gives enough energy to the system to give rise to whole new quarks, which then immediately bond to the quarks, allowing no quark to run free. So that was the mistake I made. They can be separated from their original partners, but we never find them alone because the energy put into the system creates whole new quark systems. So, for the creationist claim this week, I was doing a little discussion on a forum, and someone brought up the law of biogenesis. And he stated that the law of biogenesis excludes the possibility of abiogenesis, which is life from non-living material. The law of biogenesis is attributed to a man named Louis Pasteur, he's famous for pasteurization. Before Pasteur, it was believed that flies would spontaneously appear in rotting meat fully formed. Pasteur disproved this notion of spontaneous generation, and he summed this up in his finding can be summed up in a statement that is omne vivum ex vivo. I don't know if I pronounced the Latin correctly, but that means all life is from life. Now, what creationists seem to do is they take what Pasteur found and they say, well, biogenesis is impossible because the statement is all life is from life, and we're talking about a law here. Laws can't be violated. The law of biogenesis says there should be no such thing as chemicals giving rise to life. Well, first of all, if we look back in the historical context, we find that what Louis Pasteur was actually disproving was spontaneous generation, the poof magical appearance of fully formed creatures in non-living material. And that is not what a biogenesis is all about. A biogenesis doesn't say, here we have a rock, poof, fully formed human being. What a biogenesis is it's a process that takes chemicals and replicating biological systems, and they slowly become a living material. This isn't a poof thing at all. It's not spontaneous generation. So what creationists do is they straw man what the actual views of a biogenesis are, and they say it requires this kind of faith that we have a rock and poof, it will turn into some living entity really quickly. That's not it at all. So the law of biogenesis does not actually apply to a biogenesis. And we got to remember that Louis Pasteur created this law, and he discovered that this principle that spontaneous generation doesn't actually occur, he discovered it long before we had our current theories discussing the whole notion of a biogenesis. He discovered this entity long before we started talking about chemical origins of life. So the whole notion of applying the law of biogenesis to a biogenesis is not a really appropriate context, and that's where the creationist claim regarding biogenesis fails. Moving on now into our topic, we are going to be discussing time and time travel. Describing time in any other terms is a bit difficult because time is a fundamental entity, and it would really be useless for me to try and describe it in any other way that doesn't already entail its existence. How else could I describe time? Say time is a means of measuring things from one point in time, so I'm going back to time again. There's no real way to describe time in a way that doesn't already discuss time. So, I'll give up on trying to define it, because we pretty much know what it is. We have various methods of keeping time, and these are seconds, minutes, hours, centuries, millennia, etc., but these are all arbitrary divisions. We can split up time any which way we want to. Time is also relative to the observer, as we will later discover. And time itself might not be continuous. Continuous meaning we could arbitrarily break up time into smaller and smaller bits forever. However, as I was saying, time might not be continuous, but instead be composed of tiny steps that we just can't see right now. Time might really just be a slideshow. It might not be a continuous set of motions. I'll talk about this in just one second. First, however, let's look at a famous paradox that's going to kind of lead into this notion of discrete units of time. In the 5th century BCE, a Greek philosopher named Zeno of Elea composed his famous Paradoxes of Motion. If anyone's ever been in a calculus class, you might have heard about this, because calculus is one of the ways to solve this paradox. The paradox goes something like this. If you stand at a wall and want to get to the other side, you must first go half the distance to the wall. But in order to first go that halfway, you must go a quarter of the total distance, or half of the half. And so on, this requires an infinite number of steps, so how do you even get started? You shouldn't even be able to move. Well, integral calculus solved this paradox about 2,000 years after it was proposed, but one other notion, that of a tiniest distance, could solve this as well. You couldn't just keep arbitrarily dividing the distances if there came a point when you could no longer divide the distance. This distance, it seems, is known as the Planck length. Now, various thought experiments regarding black holes and the uncertainty principle led to the discovery of this Planck length. It's a very, very tiny measurement. It's perhaps a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a meter, 10 to the negative 33rd meters for those who are familiar with scientific notation. But we can apply Zeno's paradox to time. If we take 1 second, half a second, a quarter second, well, how can time even flow if we have to go back infinitely far in order to get started? Again, though we can solve this with integral calculus, if we have a fundamental unit of time, one that cannot be divided up further, this would solve the problem as well. If we look at Newton's equations, d equals vt, it seems that if we took the shortest distance possible, and we took it at the greatest speed, we could find the smallest unit of time. So if I traverse the smallest distance as fast as physically possible, well, that must be the smallest unit of time, and I could no longer arbitrarily break that up. As already stated, the shortest distance is the Planck length, which is about 100 millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a meter. And the fastest speed is, of course, the speed of light, which is around 300 million meters per second. Now, using our Newton's formula, we arrive at the shortest interval of time being approximately 5.3 times 10 to the power of the negative 44 seconds, or for those of you who don't like scientific notation, this is a billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, an extremely short interval, and this interval is known as the Planck time. Now, in regards to space-time, it breaks down in the form we know when it gets to the first Planck time and the Planck length. Problems arise for our understanding of the early universe with these units because we don't know how to apply relativity and quantum mechanics in a way that will coincide so we can get the results of both without them contradicting one another. You see, what happens is when we apply relativity and quantum mechanics in an era that they're both of equal strength, they create different results. They give different answers, and these answers conflict with one another. And so without a way to harmonize these two answers, we're stuck and we can't really probe before the Planck time and the Planck length, which doesn't make any sense right now because if the Planck time is the most fundamental unit of time, how could there be a beforehand? We might talk about this in a later episode when we discuss string theory, perhaps. Going back, I had stated that time is relative to the observer. However, this wasn't always the thought process in human history. Throughout the history of time, there's been a lot of thought regarding what time actually is and how it flows. We're going to be dealing with two main branches, which are absolute and relative. For most of human history, it was assumed that time was absolute. That is, no matter where you are in the universe, no matter how fast you're going, no matter what gravitational field you're sitting in, the perception of time is always going to be the same. Clocks are always going to tick at the same rate to any observer in any location. Absolute time and space are the background in what Newton formulated his theories in. In Newton's universe, space and time were the background on which things happened to occur. They were the unmoving scenery in the play which is the universe. Now, in the early 20th century, with the advent of special and general relativity, it was discovered that time wasn't actually absolute, but it was relative to the observer, and it was based on speed and gravitational pull. If the universe were one big play, if we take our analogy again, it would be like the actors are going to affect the scenery. Now, as I had stated before, when we try to apply quantum mechanics and relativity to certain eras where they are of equal strength, we run into problems. We don't know how to handle the situation. And again, hopefully we'll be able to solve this with the advent of string theory, and we'll see how it applies to these early eras. But we take our view that quantum mechanics says we have discrete units of time, and we take relativity, which says time is actually continuous, we run into these problems because they have two different views of time themselves. Moving on to time travel itself, this has been a big issue. I've been getting a lot of emails regarding time travel, if it's actually possible, how it occurs. I'm just going to talk a little bit about time travel because I'm not too familiar with it. I did read a book on time travel, which I'm going to kind of advertise now. It is called Time Travel in Einstein's Universe. It was a good book on all things related to time travel, so if anyone's interested in time travel and wants to learn a bit more, I would highly recommend checking this book out. One of the reasons I found time travel interesting initially is because I would, well, like to go back in time. That'd be pretty interesting. Go back, see George Washington, go visit the dinosaurs, something cool like that, right? Well, when I was reading Time Travel in Einstein's Universe, I found out that this, well, really isn't possible. And a good point has been brought up by Stephen Hawking, which kind of hints at the problem with this notion that we could go arbitrarily back in time as far back as we wanted to. And his problem was that he was asking, why are we not swarmed with tourists from the future? If time travel is possible, why shouldn't we have all these people from all different eras coming to visit the past? And a reasonable conclusion would be that it's just not possible. If time travel is possible, it must be limited to when a device that allows time travel is actually built. For example, if we built a time travel machine in the year 2760, you couldn't go back in time to visit 2759. But if the machine was still up and running in, say, 2900, it is theoretically possible to go back and visit 2760 when the machine was built. The point is, you can't travel back in time to a point where time travel wasn't actually invented. So I can't go back and visit the dinosaurs, unfortunately. But we can still go back in time, theoretically, if we have a time machine available. However, time travel itself is filled with various paradoxes that regard the consistency of history. For example, let's take the grandfather paradox. This is a very famous paradox regarding time travel that says, if you go back in time and, say, do something rash like murder your grandfather, this means that one of your parents wouldn't have been born, and therefore you shouldn't have been born either. So how do you exist in the first place to kill your grandfather? To solve the grandfather paradox, what we can do is borrow from the many worlds hypothesis, which was originally proposed as a possible solution to another paradox known as Schrödinger's cat. I might have talked about this paradox in an earlier episode. What basically occurs is we have a certain chain of events that leads to either a cat living or a cat dying. But we can't actually see the cat, and so we assign a probability to the cat's being alive or dead. And before we actually observe the cat, it happens to be in the state of being alive and being dead at the same time, and it doesn't really make any sense. And this world's hypothesis, what it does is it says the cat actually exists in a bunch of different histories. There's a history where the cat dies, there's a history where the cat lives, there's a history where the cat's not even in the box. A bunch of weird ideas like that. And so we borrow this many worlds hypothesis, and what we say is that if you go, say, back in time and murder your grandfather, well, it doesn't actually affect the history that has already occurred. It instead spawns off and creates a new history, one where you don't actually exist and your grandfather was actually murdered by you. And so this is the really, really only way we can solve this problem at the time, is by saying that we have these branches of histories that occur. Again, we're going to assume that time travel is possible to even give us this paradox, to even mean something. So if we take the many worlds hypothesis, if you murder your grandfather, the new universe would take this into account, but it would leave the original universe untouched and intact. Now, there are various forms of possible ways to time travel. I'm going to be discussing one mainly, but we should remember that there is a way we can sort of time travel already, and that's by moving really, really fast. If we move really, really fast, what happens is we experience time dilation. Time appears to go slower for us than the rest of the world. If we were to travel at some high speed that's a significant fraction of the speed of light, what happens is we age slower than the people around us. This is a basic consequence of special relativity. And if we're also going to look at general relativity, we find that we can also age slower if we're not in the pull of a gravitational field, or we're in the pull of a gravitational field, but it's just not as strong where we are. And we've discovered this, we've even tested this by taking atomic clocks and flying them around the world, and we found that at this different altitude, the gravitational field of the Earth is a bit weaker, and these atomic clocks have aged, have ticked slower than they would closer to the Earth. So using relativity, we can find that it's, you know, we don't go back in time, and we don't age that much slower, but we do know that we can age slower, and that, again, this verifies our view that time is relative. But to make things interesting, I'm going to talk about the time travel technique that involves objects called wormholes. Everyone knows about wormholes if they've seen Star Trek or just heard it anywhere. Wormholes are a pretty popular science fiction term that gets tossed around a lot. Now, wormholes are hypothetical objects in space-time, and what they do is they bridge two regions of space-time. So instead of taking the long way around, for example, you just take this bridge, and you can beat light that travels all the way around, takes the long way, you can just go right through this bridge, this tunnel, and arrive at the other side before light does. Now remember, we aren't actually traveling faster than the speed of light when we go through this wormhole. You're not traveling at, say, 186,200 miles per second. What you're doing is you're just taking the shortcut in space-time and beating the light all the way around. Light's still traveling faster than you physically, but it's just taking the long way around in space-time, and you're just taking the shortcut. However, if you think about it, this isn't actually going back in time. This is just defeating light. You're taking a shortcut in space. What is the time travel factor that we can use wormholes with? Well, we need to look at some relativity in order to do this. If you remember the twin paradox from the episode I did on relativity, we need to borrow the concept of the twin paradox and use it here with the wormholes. A wormhole has two mouths. You have one end you enter and one end you leave. Now, if you could take one of these ends, one of these mouths, and accelerate it in relation to the other mouth and then bring it back to its original position, the time would have passed slower for the moving mouth than for the one that was stationary. Now, if you enter the stationary mouth, you're going to exit the other side at a time that was before you entered the non-moving one, because the time would have ticked slower for the mouth that had moved than the one that was stationary. So if you enter the stationary one, you're going to exit before it even entered it. It's a bizarre concept, I know, but relativity seems to allow it. It seems to be physically possible. However, wormholes, there's a problem with wormholes. One of them is that we don't actually have any verification that they exist. That could be a big problem for time travel. If wormholes don't actually exist, what good is it using a wormhole if they aren't actually there? One other problem that deals with keeping a wormhole stable is that it requires something known as exotic matter. This form of matter is hypothetical, we haven't actually seen it, and it's going to have some very bizarre properties. One is being repulsed by gravity instead of being attracted by gravity like everything else in existence. And there are some other weird properties, such as it having negative mass, which doesn't make any sense. So exotic matter is a very hypothetical and bizarre notion that would be required to keep a wormhole stable. Wormholes can't use normal matter to keep themselves propped open. So while the wormhole could allow time travel, it'd be hard to locate one if they actually exist, and let alone find exotic matter in a significant enough quantity to be able to keep a wormhole stable in order for us to pass through it. Now, there was one other problem that existed for wormholes that might not be a problem anymore, and had to deal with the virtual particles spawning within the wormhole. And the spawning of these virtual particles might cause them to just go back and forth between the wormhole, getting more and more energetic as they go through until we have infinite radiation inside the wormhole because of this increased speed that the virtual particles travel in there, going back and forth and back and forth. And eventually, if they radiate fast enough, they're just going to basically destroy the wormhole or kill anything that goes in there, because we're going to have infinite radiation because they travel back and forth through the wormhole an infinite amount of time. But apparently, this doesn't seem to be a problem anymore because, well, the radiation might just pass through the wormhole. So it's been brought into question, and this doesn't look like an issue for the wormhole idea anymore. But the other two, a wormhole actually existing and exotic matter, they are a problem. And if they don't actually exist, then we cannot travel back in time using wormholes. Now, if you want to read that book I suggested earlier, the author goes into a lot more detail than I will on time travel, because he knows a lot more. And he also discusses some interesting concepts like the universe actually being spawned from a universe that had been cyclical or cyclical, and that it would never actually end. this universe was basically a time travel universe. He goes into a bunch of weird objects like Misner space, which happens to be a room. If you were in a room, for example, say this room is a Misner space, what you'd do is you'd walk through one door and appear in the one that led into the room. So you'd exit the room in a door and you'd enter the room again. There'd be no escape. And he talks about this Misner space. It's a very interesting concept. And he also discusses Minkowski space-time, which allows you to discuss relativity, which builds into the whole wormhole concept. It's a very interesting book. I was thinking of checking it out again to kind of help me look over this episode, but I decided to, you know, pass it. I got lazy, so I decided to just give you a taste of time travel for this episode and let you go read the book if you were more interested. So, in conclusion, we have these four fundamental things you should keep in mind. And the first is that time is most likely not incremental. It is most likely incremental, but not continuous. The smallest proposed time is the Planck time, or the Planck time. I pronounce it both ways sometimes, so I'm just going to do it like that. Now, there are two main schools of thought regarding time, and they are absolute and relative. Einstein's theory of relativity only allows relative time, and this is because, for example, if you took two lightning strikes on the ends of a train, to two different observers, well, to one observer they'd be simultaneous, and that'd be the observer on the train, and to one observer they would not be simultaneous. So if there's one event and one is it's simultaneous to one person only and not simultaneous to the other, well then time can't be absolute. The simultaneousness doesn't apply everywhere. So that's one reason why time is relative and it's not absolute. Next, time travel is possible with wormholes, theoretically. But time travel is only possible as long as the mechanism you use to do the time travel exists. So we can't travel back in time before the time travel was invented. This solves Stephen Hawking's question of how come we're not being swarmed with tourists from the future. Consistency paradoxes like the grandfather paradox are solved when we posit multiple histories or multiple universes. If you go back and murder your grandfather, which I don't suggest doing, what'll happen is a new universe, a new history is going to spawn so that you're not going to affect the one that you're already in. Now, the next episode, I have some plans for the next episode. I'm starting to read a book called Shattering the Myths of Darwinism. It's by someone who says they're critical of the mutational theory of natural selection. They don't argue against evolution, but they argue against the mechanism of mutations coupled with natural selection. And so if I get far enough into that book, I'm going to be discussing it. If not, I'm most likely going to be talking about string theory or particle physics. I've been watching the Elegant Universe series, PBS series, again, and I find string theory very interesting. I'm still reading the Warp Passages book by Lisa Randall. It's been months since I started it, and I still haven't finished it, and I've got quite a bit to go. But I've learned quite a bit in the meantime, and I'd like to do a bit of discussion on that. If anybody else has any suggestions for the show, or you have some questions or concerns, my email is rlippens, R-L-I-P-P-E-N-S, @wavecable.com, or you can visit the website at lucretius1.blogspot.com, and feel free to post anything there, and it's got a link to the forums, too, there. There's only about one person who posts in the forums, and she knows who she is. But if you want to help revive the forums, please do. Well, in the meantime, I'm going to compose the next episode. If you have any suggestions again, feel free to email them to me. Until then, I guess we will talk next week. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.